From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The 2016 presidential race is in full swing, and candidates from both parties are fighting to maintain popularity among potential voters. But over the last few months, protesters associated with the Black Lives Matter movement have made it clear that they are upset with the way Democratic candidates are addressing racial inequality, criminal justice reform, police brutality, and other race-related issues. Critics of the protesters say they're fighting against their own allies, possibly hurting the candidates who are their best friends. This hour, On Point, Black Lives Matter, Black Voters, and the Democratic Party. And later this hour, we'll be remembering the life of civil rights leader Julian Bond. Joining me first today from New Orleans, Louisiana, is Janelle Ross. She reports on race, gender, immigration, and inequality for The Washington Post. Janelle, welcome back to On Point.
Hello.
So could you review for us some of these disruptions, the protests we've seen, particularly at Democratic presidential candidate events by groups like Black Lives Matter?
I'm not sure that I can review them all. I think there have been
give us highlights,
several. But certainly I think that one that drew quite a bit of attention and perhaps focus to this issue, and then there have been subsequent protests in the weeks since, is a group that walked onto the stage at Netroots back in July and during a presidential campaign forum. And both Senator Sanders and former Governor O'Malley had agreed to speak at this event, and both of their sessions were, in essence, disrupted.
And then there was also a very prominent situation in Seattle involving Bernie Sanders.
That is true. Another Sanders campaign event, in this case organized by the campaign itself, during which protesters who've described themselves as Black Lives Matter protesters walked onto the stage and requested a moment of silence, which the campaign did in fact comply with. And then there have also been protests also at a Jeb Bush campaign event. And there have been some other attempts at protest at other events, including a Hillary Clinton campaign event.
Attempts because basically the campaign was aware that might happen and they were able to stop it. But I believe that the Black Lives Matter group did get about 15 minutes of one-on-one time with Hillary Clinton later.
That is true, although I think there have been some conflicting reports about exactly how it is that the campaign managed to avoid an actual protest during the event. There have been some reports that the protesters were late and therefore unable to clear security in time to position themselves for the protest that they had in mind.
Rather than blocked when they had arrived there on time.
Mm-hmm.
Janelle, could you also mention the issue that's come up over the phrase itself, Black Lives Matter? Because several of the candidates have said publicly all lives matter, and they've taken a great amount of flack for that.
That is true. That is true. And I'll want to just say up front that this is what I have gathered in conversations with Black Lives Matter activists and from our reporting as well as other reporting that I've read. I think the concern is this, that there has been a long-term denial in the United States about the particular peril that Black Americans face and, quite frankly, Black and Latino Americans face in their interactions with the police. And not only that sometimes, and obviously these occasions are rare, but not only that sometimes that interactions with the police can become violent and even deadly, but that these events often go unaddressed legally. It is extremely rare at this point for a police officer to be indicted, and even more rare for an officer to actually be convicted of any sort of crime in connection with his work or her work.
So for a candidate to be criticized for saying all lives matter, the idea is that it sounds dismissive or it seems to minimize the very unique and very real issues that Black voters and Black Americans in particular face.
Correct, correct. I think that that is the essential complaint or concern when candidates have used language such as all lives matter or subsequently, I think that's certainly something that we've seen people who are perhaps not supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement sort of toy with that phrase or that language in ways that I think are intended to be insulting. You, I'm sure, are aware that there are all sorts of campaigns. There have been bumper stickers and T-shirts printed with Confederate Lives Matter, you name it, all sorts of groups. So it's certainly it's language that has become particularly charged.
Janelle Ross, most of the candidates, if not all of the candidates, have addressed racial justice issues in their campaigns in some way. What is it exactly that the Black Lives Matter movement wants them to do more? What is it saying is not satisfying about what they're hearing from the candidates now, and in particular from the Democratic candidates?
I think what I'm hearing is two things. First, I think it's important to recognize the context in which this movement has developed. This is a movement that developed in fits and starts in the months after the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, and certainly after George Zimmerman was acquitted on all charges in that case. And in the months and unfortunately years that have followed, there have been a number of deaths of unarmed African American, mostly young men, but also some young women, either in interactions with the police or in police custody, and very, very few prosecutions, and certainly even fewer convictions.
And most candidates would agree that that is an outrage. What about that is dissatisfying for Black Lives Matter protesters and activists?
I think that we have a current president who has also agreed that pattern is certainly troubling, perhaps an outrage, to borrow your language. And so, given that that is something that these protesters are already hearing from the current president, I think if you followed that logic, the idea that these protesters might be looking for something more, something specific, some actual policy prescriptions, some promises to which the candidates can actually be held, is not completely, I guess, far-fetched or difficult to follow. That the logic is, we already have a president who is at least concerned and or sympathetic, but sympathy has not arrested this trend. And so something more is required, I think, is what these activists are trying to get across to the campaigns and what they are saying to the campaigns.
What has been particularly interesting, I think, about this Black Lives Matter sort of rift with the Democrats, in a sense, is that even Bernie Sanders, you know, the ultimate progressive, the self-described Democratic socialist, has not been spared. I mean, people say he is probably Black Lives Matter's best ally here. So on one hand, people have been critical of Black Lives Matter for going after candidates like that. On the other hand, Bernie Sanders, having been gone after, is basically what prompted him to put together a very detailed racial justice policy, which he didn't have before he was criticized by the Black Lives Matter activists. So in that sense, does the movement say, this is exactly what we wanted, this is effective, this is why we need to take on even our friends?
I think so. That's precisely what I hear from the activists that I've talked with, that this is what we want. We want not sort of general sympathy or empathy, but rather some very specific commitments and policy ideas that can be examined, that can be, you know, certainly monitored if ever put in place, and, you know, criticized if they are not working. I think also in a very real way, the absence of that kind of policy prior to these protests was for many of these activists evidence that liberalism, or what it means to even be a democratic socialist like Bernie Sanders, was not necessarily inclusive of a really rich and rigorous racial justice policy program, that racial justice wasn't necessarily a central part of the left agenda, and it is their goal to make those issues central to any Democratic campaign.
And do they also want to do the same with Republican candidates?
I think, you know, it would be certainly reasonable to expect that the Black Lives Matter activists, and certainly those that I've spoken with, would like to see racial justice become a larger priority in all of the campaigns, and certainly in inside of whatever administration takes shape after the 2016 campaign, be it a Republican one or a Democratic-led one.
Janelle Ross, in your reporting on these issues for The Washington Post, have you talked with Black Lives Matter activists about whether perhaps being very critical of Democrats could hurt the Democratic candidates to the point that maybe a Democrat would lose a chance to win office? And is there any concern among Black Lives Matters activists that a Republican candidate could win and they could end up with a president who would be less friendly and less of an ally than a Democrat would have been?
I think that that is certainly an issue of concern and something that is discussed within the movement. But also, like many strategies in protest movements and in politics, there are risks and potential rewards that are weighed constantly, and those certainly rank among them. I think, in fairness, what I have heard more than one activist say is that realistically, the movement does not see itself as likely to gain any real traction or see any of the Republican candidates move on this issue and begin to really take it on as a central part of their campaign. So they are essentially forced to focus on Democrats, where it is understood that the Black vote is critical, if not essential, to any Democrat's election. It is going to be very difficult for any Democrat to win several key states with large hauls of Electoral College votes if they cannot get out the Black vote.
We've been talking with Janelle Ross. She covers race, gender, immigration, and inequality for The Washington Post. And joining me now from Baltimore, Maryland, is civil rights and Black Lives Matter activist DeRay McKesson. DeRay, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here. I appreciate it.
And we're glad to have you. And DeRay, I'd like to go to a piece of sound. This is from that Bernie Sanders rally in Seattle, where Black Lives Matter protesters disrupted it. I think Bernie didn't get much of a chance, if any chance, to speak. This is Marissa Johnson. She identifies herself as a Black Lives Matter activist. And she called for a moment of silence in the crowd to remember the teenager whose death sparked so much anger last summer.
We are going to honor the memory of Michael Brown, and we are going to honor all of the Black lives lost this year, and we're going to honor the fact that I have to fight through all these people who said, my life matters! That I have to get up here in front of a bunch of screaming white racists!
DeRay, you are so involved in this. You know every aspect of the support for Black Lives Matter, of the criticism of Black Lives Matter. As you listen to that sound again, I'm interested in your general thoughts on what Black Lives Matter has achieved, where you think it may have been weak. How are you feeling right now about the conversation that's been stirred?
Yeah, remember that a year ago when we were in the streets in St. Louis and Ferguson, that people had not yet understood that there was a crisis with policing across the country. They thought that it was isolated to Ferguson and maybe to the St. Louis region. In a year, that has fundamentally changed. People understand that there's a crisis, right? That there only been 9 days in 2015 where the police haven't killed somebody, only 3 states where the police haven't killed somebody, and the police have killed over 700 people this year. People acknowledge the crisis, and there's language to talk about the crisis in ways that are really important. The reality is that we shouldn't have to protest, right? Like, people should not have to protest to be heard in what we call this America. That protest is a last resort because people have not been heard, and people have been terrorized in their own communities by the very people who are supposed to protect them. So that is why people are on streets and on stages, and we will never be at a place where people agree with all of the tactics. But remember, the first part of the movement was about exposing and convincing. It was about exposing the terror of police violence and helping people understand, convincing them that this is actually closer to them than they ever thought, that there's a Mike Brown in every town and Ferguson is just a step away.
DeRay, I want to read you a sampling of some comments that our listeners posted on Facebook. The first is a little trio in support of Black Lives Matter. Whitney Arlene Crispell wrote, what I want Senator Sanders to do is address his white supporters who are disparaging Black Lives Matters, and these activists, and tell them there is no room in the Sanders movement for this behavior. I want them to check their egos, check their impulse to condescend and lecture, and listen. This is Stacey Melinda. She says, I was incensed at first at Black Lives Matters, but they have a valid point. If progressives are not going to rally behind them, we're not progressives. Good on them for getting our attention. And here's Anakia German. Whether Republican or Democrat, every non-Black candidate needs to pay attention to this movement. Those are clearly supporters. Here are some people who are not supporters of Black Lives Matter. This is Craig Nelson. He says Black Lives Matter is a disorganized mess with no accountability. They are angry, as they should be, but only yell, cause traffic jams, vandalize, and ultimately push support away. Here's a Noah Brown. Right or wrong, they're acting like spoiled children. It's weird they showed up under Bernie and not Trump. Here's a Bob Terrell. I'm more likely to stop caring about the Black Lives Matter movement than I am to hold anyone accountable if this is how they're going to go about it. Now, those are obviously very polarized opinions on both sides. Do you have any sense of whether, as you hear this, you think the movement is exactly what it needs to be, has accomplished what it needs to be? Does it need to change course in any way as you hear that?
You know, people told us to go home in August of last year. People, the same people who are the biggest supporters of the movement now are the very people who told us that we were wasting our times in the street in Ferguson, that we should not be out there, that this wasn't the way to bring attention to an issue, that we were making this up, right? So I'm used to being in spaces where people don't immediately understand the importance of the work or why people are upset. The reality is that so many of us will go home to memorials and not whole families anymore because the police have killed people. When I think about the tactics and strategies is that people will never always agree on them, and that's real. And people, like Black people, shouldn't have to beg to be heard in the Democratic space. So what is hard is that all three candidates made statements sort of close to this All Lives Matter a year into the movement, right? And there is this question of like, were you listening? Were you there? In a year, what we've seen recently is all three candidates make statements or release platforms that seem to suggest a response to the conditions of unrest. So you see O'Malley's comprehensive plan that is really strong, and now he just needs to talk about how that squares up to his time as mayor. You see with Sanders, the outline of a really progressive platform hinged around this idea of violence and justice in a way that seems to have a lot of promise. So I'm looking forward to what the next phase of it is. And with the Clinton campaign, she's dropped some hints about what she might roll out in a platform in speeches, but we are waiting for her platform to come out. And I know that she's reaching out to people to get feedback because I've talked to people in the movement that her campaign has reached out to.
DeRay McKesson, not surprisingly, we have a number of callers who'd like to weigh in, and I'd like to go to one from New Haven, Connecticut. This is John. And John, you're on the air.
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
For your guest, you know, it's obvious to me the aim of Black Lives Matter all along has been to undermine law enforcement and to decrease police scrutiny on the Black criminal element. Now that we are seeing the results of this with increasing inner city crime rates, when the full effect of BLM comes into play, will the Black community reap what they sowed, or will it be Whitey's fault per usual?
John, thanks for your call. DeRay, that certainly is a taste of people who don't support the movement. Your thoughts on that caller?
Just to be clear, that comment was not just people who don't support the movement, but it was a comment about people who don't support justice or any sort of equity for non-white people in America, right? What he just said was such a defining statement about white supremacy and how it manifests in America. So the reality is Black people shouldn't have to beg or shouldn't have to do anything to say that the state shouldn't kill them, right? And the protests are about bringing visibility to the fact that the state is killing people in record numbers and should not be. So it is not about undermining law enforcement. It is about saying that if this is a profession, then act like a professional, right? And it's about saying that like part of the work of policing is not to kill the people that you're supposed to protect. And what we know to be true is that the safety of communities is not predicated on the presence of police. That safety is a much more expansive notion than policing. That safety is strong schools, it is healthcare, it is jobs, it is workforce development. And what the police would like you to believe is what that caller would like you to believe, that Black people, our bodies must be controlled by people who can kill us for us to be safe. And that is just simply untrue and is one of the defining hallmarks of like how white supremacy manifests in public thought.
DeRay McKesson, I'd like to bring in another guest, and this is Charlton McElwain. He is a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University and co-director of the Project on Race and Political Communication. He's also co-author of Race Appeal, How Candidates Invoke Race in U.S. Political Campaigns. Charlton, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Sasha.
And Charlton, to set us in history a little bit, can you also sort of remind us, I mean, for many decades, the Democratic Party has had great support from Black voters, pretty reliable. I'm wondering, as you look at this anger that the Black Lives Movement is directing towards Democratic candidates, how significant is that to you? How much of a rift does it seem in that longtime supportive relationship?
I think it is very significant, and I think what it shows is not just a backlash against a particular kind of sentiment from political candidates, but the need to suggest a fundamental reorientation in the way that racial politics, black politics in particular, gets played within the Democratic Party. And so for at least the last 20, 25 years, there's been the strategic plan and a plan that African-American candidates, non-white candidates have gone along with as well that says the way that we solve the problems of black people is to solve the problems of all people. We focus on everyone, all Americans. And to the degree that there are disparities and inequalities in the world and in the country, those will be solved if we focus on the problems of everyone. And I think the Black Lives Matter activist movement and everything that goes along with it suggests we need to fundamentally change this direction to say that now is a time that black problems, black issues, black interests deserve fundamentally specific focus and strategic focus in terms of how they can be addressed and changed.
Duray McKesson, back to you for a question that I also put to Janelle Ross, which is, as you know, many people were very surprised that Bernie Sanders in particular, a very progressive candidate, was a target of the Black Lives Matter movement. There was a feeling that if Black Lives Matter doesn't see an ally in Bernie Sanders, then what other Democrat could be better for them, basically. I'm interested in your thoughts on that. Was there a risk, in a sense, of targeting Bernie Sanders, or do you feel like because he was prompted by that to put out a detailed racial justice plan, that's exactly what the goal was?
Yeah, let's be clear that the protests are about people's dissatisfaction with the structure and system that is killing people, right? With the apparatus of government and policing. And the Democratic candidates, all the candidates, right? There's this, in even in your statements, there's this undertone that like black people just must automatically be aligned with a certain set of people or that. And that just isn't true, right? That like people have a right to question the people who are supposed to lead, right? The people who want to lead. Part of the democratic process is to press those people and to ask them, like, how do I fit into your vision? And that's what protest does. People don't like the way it happened, and I understand that. That makes sense to me, and we will never always agree on tactics inside the movement or without. But there's this interesting spin about, like, black people shouldn't even be able to ask people, like, how we fit into the vision of an America that they want to lead. And that is both insulting and just not true to anybody's understanding of like a democratic vision.
And to your point about this sort of the sense that some people assume that there will be this automatic alignment or friendship, I noted that the Black Lives Matter movement does make very clear that it is not affiliated with a political party. And as it puts it, it believes all political parties over time have participated in the systemic disenfranchisement of black people. So it's a matter of addressing both Democratic and Republican candidates. Charlton McElwain, do you see this movement having a significant impact on how the presidential race plays out? Do you see it potentially changing the way candidates how they talk to voters?
I think it's possible, and I think that possibility lies with the degree to which folks are able to secure the votes. I mean, that's really what's up for grabs in the election. And so we see that 90-95% of African Americans voting for Democratic candidates in the last two or three elections. If folks are able to harness that power that comes with that voting block that's seen today as necessary to the success of Democratic candidates and say we are going to either mobilize or withhold that vote depending on what you, the presidential candidate, say you're going to do about this problem addressing racial inequality, black inequality, and all the issues related to it, I think it can significantly change the course of this election.
Let's go back to another caller because we have many of them that would like to weigh in. And this is Saeed from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Saeed, you're on the air.
Hi, Sasha. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I fundamentally disagree with the premise that this movement can only find solutions in the Democratic Party and that they will find no answers from the Republicans. Look, blacks have voted en bloc for the Democratic Party for the last at least three decades. They need to hold this party accountable because the outcomes have not been good. In my own state of Wisconsin, where the public schools of Milwaukee have become the graveyard of the dreams of minority kids, the Democratic Party stands firmly in the way of education reform. it is time for this movement and blacks in general to reconsider their en bloc affiliation with the Democratic Party, because it is being taken for granted, and the results could be better if they diversify their political approach.
Saeed, thanks for that. DeRay, comment on that one?
I mean, so there are so many Republican candidates that I don't even know what it means to focus on them right now. They're just so many. So I too am interested in knowing what they have to say about equity or justice or anything about race, like once there aren't 2,000 of them. So people are looking at them. Nobody is immune. We understand that there will be a next president, right? That there will. And that, like, we'd like to know as much about that person as possible. And we plan to, like, to hold everybody accountable for how they for the vision that they put forth about an America and how we fit into that vision. But there are just simply so many candidates right now on that side.
DeRay, if ultimately a Republican candidate won the White House and there was a sense that partly the Black Lives Matter movement resulted in that because it was so hard on the Democratic candidates, would that feel to you like a outcome you had not hoped for? Would that feel like the movement backfired? Is that not what you ultimately want to see happen?
I mean, I don't think the movement is going to – candidates have an opportunity right now to engage Black people, especially Black young people, differently. And we will see whether they do that or not, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. If they do, this could be a promising opportunity for them. I don't think that anything that the protesters are asking for is incredible, is unseemly, is too much, right? Like, it is not too much to say that the police shouldn't kill people. It is not too much to say that young people should not be in solitary confinement. Like, none of these things are too much. The end of broken windows policing is not too much. So we are asking for justice in ways that make sense. And I think that in the coming days, you'll see people put forth policy ideas that like really help get there. But I don't think that, again, I think that the onus is on the candidates to mobilize Black people in ways that they have not before. And I think the protest space provides a phenomenal opportunity for that to happen if they're up to the challenge.
Charlton, you probably only have about 40 seconds for this answer because we have a break coming up. But I'm wondering if you think that there are some Democrats afraid to engage with Black Lives Matter or to appease Black voters out of fear of losing other more conservative groups.
Absolutely. I think that you see a trend that begins way back, really, with the 70s, with advertising, and as it dovetails with politics, that says if we focus on one group of people, considering whites to be the mainstream, if we focus on blacks, if we focus on Latinos, if we focus on people of color, that all of a sudden then makes me the candidate that champions that small minority group. And doing so carries risks in terms of its perception amongst that larger white mainstream. And I think that's the very calculus that's been going through the minds of candidates in this election, particularly within the Democratic Party.
Charlton McElwain, DeRay McKesson, and Janelle Ross, please stand by. We'll be back after a short break. We're discussing the 2016 presidential race and how candidates, Democratic candidates in particular, are responding to calls by the Black Lives Matter movement for more attention to racial equality. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the call from activists for presidential candidates to focus more on racial inequality, criminal justice reform, and more. We're talking with Charlton McElwain, professor of media, culture, and communication at NYU. He's co-author of Race Appeal, How Candidates Invoke Race in U.S. Political Campaigns. DeRay McKesson is a civil rights and Black Lives Matter activist, and Janelle Ross covers race, gender, immigration, and inequality for The Washington Post. And we still have many callers who'd like to weigh in, so I'd like to go to one immediately, and this is KK from Cambridge, Massachusetts. KK, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Sasha. What I want to say to people who say, well, all lives matter, is that is a huge insult. The reason why Black people came up with this whole idea of, say Black Lives Matter, because they were beginning to feel that indeed Black Lives did not matter. They were seeing their children mowed down by police at the slightest provocation. And when they were thinking, whoa, our lives matter too. So maybe they should have said Black Lives Matter too. But it seems to most Black people, I promise you, that Black lives don't matter, that they're in fact very expendable. And why are they going to the Democratic Party? Because those are who has been our friend. We're not going to go to the Republican Party because we already know their hostility. We've seen how they treated Obama. We see how the first thing Mitch McConnell said when he was reelected was, our goal is to make sure this man gets a one-term presidency, not I'm going to do this and that for my people. So Black people know they're going to the Democrats and they're holding them accountable, saying, hey, we've been your friends. Now, what are you going to do for us? Black lives do matter, and I just want to stress that. Black lives do matter.
KK, thank you for that call, and I'm glad you brought that up because the language has been such a key issue in this. And, DeRay, I'd like to go to you for this because we talked about this a bit with Janelle Ross, but the idea that all lives matter, even though many people, few people, if anyone, would agree that that isn't true, can be perceived as minimizing or diminishing the very, very unique and much more difficult issues that many Black Americans deal with. Yet some people say, how did we get to a point where candidates are being pilloried for saying something like all lives matter? And it's a reminder of how difficult it is to balance the language, to balance the concerns. I'm interested in your thoughts on all that, DeRay.
Yeah, remember the context within which the candidate said it was a year into the space. So it wasn't as if this was August 2014 and people were like just trying to figure out how to, you know, the hashtag just emerged and people were trying to figure out how to talk about it. This is a year into it, and it seemed like people just weren't paying attention, right? Like, that is how it felt. It is how it still feels. And again, it shouldn't be controversial to say Black Lives Matter, right? That shouldn't even be like a controversial thing if people believe it.
Should
right?
it be controversial to say all lives matter?
Well, yeah, in the context, yes, because it's dismissive, right? Like, we know, first, it's not true, right? If all lives matter, we wouldn't be in the streets. If all lives matter, the police wouldn't be mowing people down left and right and not be held accountable in any type of way, like literally not held accountable. So if all lives matter was a true statement, like if it was true in practice, the protesters would not be protesting. And Black Lives Matter is not meant to necessarily affirm the worth of our lives because we know that we matter, but to expose the depth of the evil we face. It is in people's reaction to Black Lives Matter that we actually see an exposing of such deep hatred and animosity towards Black people and the issues that that face Black people. I'll also follow up on this thing about the GOP candidates is that the protest space is holding them accountable and sort of pushing them. And I wanted my comment about there being so many not to say that people are not holding them accountable because there's so many, but the accountability, it just looks different from 3 to 20. Like, it is that there are literally just so many people on the other side.
DeRay, you had said something a few weeks ago, or actually maybe you tweeted it, your line that coded rhetoric won't cut it. It's when you were listening to a presidential candidate talk about race. And that, I think, is key because most candidates have something vague to say about race, but for you, it's simply vague. What very specifically do you feel like you want to hear that you haven't heard from the candidates, Democratic or Republican?
Yeah, frankly, I think that the time for the rhetoric has passed, right? That, like, all three candidates on the Democratic side misspoke early enough that, like, we all question their perspective and approach to the work, and we're looking for platforms. So what we see is the O'Malley platform is very strong and covers a host of topics that are really important.
Meaning you want a detailed policy plan. You want to see here's what they will do if they're elected.
Correct. And then what we see from Sanders is like the initial underpinnings of that. And what we have from the Hillary campaign is sort of is policy things embedded into speeches, but no platform yet. Right. So I think that people are looking for the like how does your worldview inform the way that you actually plan to do things as opposed to just like tell me how you think. We were in the tell you how you think phase and that didn't go so well for any of the candidates.
Let's go to another caller. This is Charlie from Atlanta, Georgia. Charlie, you're on the air.
Hi, Sasha. I don't think we're going to solve America's racial problems in an hour.
I think we all agree on that.
And I think that I'm very upset with the Black Lives Matter movement. I think what they did to Bernie Sanders in Oregon was really reprehensible. Bernie Sanders is the only candidate among all the Democrats and Republicans who's actually talking about real issues and how they affect real people. And when this woman, Marissa Johnson, stands up there in front of a huge crowd, she was not one of the scheduled speakers, and says, we're going to sit here and not say anything for 4.5 minutes. Are you kidding me? And it was all a threat. They stand up there, we're going to shut this down if you don't do what we want you to do. We have a terrible problem in this country with police. It's not just with black people. It's mostly with black people, but it's the police themselves. The police are horribly, horribly trained in this country, and we have many police officers who, once they have a gun, think they're Marshall Dillon, and they're walking down the streets in gun smoke. This is a real, real problem. But telling Senator Sanders, you know, that his message isn't worth listening to, that's a real problem.
Charlie from Atlanta, thank you very much for that call. And Charlton McElwain, would you field that one? Do you feel like you can kind of give us your objective sense of whether you feel like that viewpoint is a fair assessment of how Black Lives Matter has played out, or if you feel like it's been an effective movement? Are you comfortable telling us how you would sort of handicap it in a sense?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one thing we can recognize is that this strategy of disruption, whether we say we like it, don't like it, disagree with it, or what have you, it's a strategy used when one thinks they do not have a voice, when they cannot get someone's attention. And so to the degree that people believe that they have not been able to get the attention of the Democratic Party, Democratic Party leaders, presidential candidates, then one absolutely can understand the strategy that says, look, you're going to look at me now. You're going to pay attention to me and our issues now. And I think the strategy reveals, again, something that's very deeply embedded in Democratic Party politics. And that is to say, everyone gives assent. Everyone understands that disparities exist, inequality exists. They will talk about it. Everyone will pass through the organizations and talk about racial justice. But for 20 years, for 30 years, even longer, no demonstrable things that have come on the table that says, I really put something behind these principles and these platitudes. So I can understand the strategy.
Charlton McElwain, thank you very much for spending this hour with us. He's a professor of media culture and communication at NYU, where he is co-director of the Project on Race and Political Communication. Charlton McElwain, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Sasha.
And Ray McKesson, thank you very much to you as well for staying with us this hour. He's a civil rights and Black Lives Matter activist. Thanks for spending the time with us. And Janelle Ross at the Washington Post, please stand by. In a moment, we'll talk about the life of one of the most influential civil rights leaders in the U.S., Julian Bond. This is On Point. On Saturday night, the country lost a civil rights icon. Julian Bond's life traced and helped shape the arc of the civil rights movement. He was one of the original leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. He went on to found the Southern Poverty Law Center. And he served the NAACP as chairman for more than 10 years before stepping down in 2010. He spoke at the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington in 2013.
This is personal for me. Like many of you, I was privileged to be here 50 years ago. And like many of you, I am the grandson of a slave.
Janelle Ross, reporter for The Washington Post, is still with us to share her experience with Julian Bond at her very first job. And also joining us from Washington is Phyllis Loeffler. She's a historian and professor at the University of Virginia, and she collaborated with Julian Bond for more than 10 years to create an oral history project called Black Leaders on Leadership. That project was turned into a book, Black Leaders on Leadership, Conversations with Julian Bond. Phyllis Loeffler, welcome to On Point.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And Janelle, tell us, you, in your first job, worked with Julian Bond. What was that job and what was your interaction with him?
My interaction with him was typically once or twice a week. I was bottom of the totem pole, if even on the totem pole, production assistant and researcher on a public affairs show on which Mr. Bond was a regular part of the panel called America's Black Forum. And as such, it was my job to provide research on that week's topics to all of the panelists and sometimes the guests, as well as, make sure that everyone felt sort of grounded and ready to really talk about the issues at hand. These were, of course, issues that had come up in the week's news. In the course of that, wound up exchanging books pretty regularly with Mr. Bond.
Sort of just trading thoughts about what you read and recommendations, that sort of thing?
Exactly. That's exactly right. I think he had some things that he thought every person should read, myself included. And in addition to that, he was always curious about what I was reading and interested in taking a look.
Do you remember what was on his must-read list?
Oh, goodness. I think he was definitely a firm believer that it was important for every American to have a clear understanding of what the Founding Fathers really thought and were writing when this country was created. So I would, of course, include Thomas Jefferson on that list. But also, I think he was really fascinated by assessments of the ways in which the United States had fallen short of the goals that it had identified for itself in its foundational documents. So he was also very interested in Alexis de Tocqueville. And I think lots of political theory writ large about democracy and representative democracies and protest and certainly nonviolence and tactics to, get different voices heard and well represented in a democracy.
What were your impressions of him personally?
He was an incredibly kind person. Certainly very, very generous, both with his time, as you can tell, and his incredible intellect. He was also pretty funny. He was the kind of person who saw a lot of humor in everything. So you could certainly rely on him to make a wry remark or say something pretty remarkably funny at any given moment of the day.
Did you feel like he taught you something lasting?
I would say certainly, in the sense that he was a person who I think remained very committed to his principles throughout his lifetime, and I think made a habit and a practice of really studying those ideas, but also challenging himself, his own assumptions, and his the ways in which how far was he willing to go to remain true to those principles, be it personally in terms of personal sacrifice, but also in terms of broadening his notions of what justice looked like and who needed to be spoken for and whose rights and needs needed to be defended and championed. And so, I think that's something that is certainly admirable. That's a difficult task to take on in a lifetime.
Phyllis Loeffler, I want to make sure we hear Phyllis Loeffler's experience working with Julian Bond as well. And Phyllis, I just want to play a piece of tape. This is a 2009 interview with CNN in which Julian Bond spoke about what he did that he was most proud of.
I always acted with groups of people, not by myself. And I think my biggest accomplishment was making sure there were strong organizations that could fight for social justice in the United States, because individuals alone probably can't do much of it themselves, but joining with others, they can do a tremendous amount.
Phyllis Loeffler, what are your most lasting memories, impressions, things you learned from having collaborated and worked with Julian Bond?
Well, I would really echo some of what Janelle has just said. He was a remarkably decent, kind, judicious human being. And he had an enormous sense of both personal dignity and distinction, but it was coupled with an equally enormous sense of respect for others. So that clip that you just played, I think, is very important and very reflective of the way in which he lived in the world. He always cared about other people's ideas and other people's thoughts. And I actually think that was one of the reasons why this Explorations in Black Leadership oral history project that we did together mattered to him. He cared about getting other people's voices to the table. He cared about having the thoughts of leaders, whether they were in arts-related areas like poetry, whether it was Nikki Giovanni or Bill T. Jones, or whether it was people who worked on the policy level like Dorothy Height, or people who worked in education like Jeffrey Canada. He wanted to make sure that all those voices got heard. And people didn't have to totally adhere to his political perspective, but I think he really wanted to promote the idea that everybody's voice mattered, had to be listened to. Of course, he had his preferences and his favorites, You know, but he was a man who just believed in total inclusion and in listening and in debating and in discussing. And obviously he really believed that America could, deeply believed that America could be a richer and better country by virtue of bringing all those voices to the table. But those are the things I think I will remember most about him. I just loved working with him.
Phyllis Loeffler, thank you very much for those memories. Phyllis is a historian and a University of Virginia professor. Her book is Black Leaders on Leadership, Conversations with Julian Bond. She joined us from Washington. Phyllis, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Janelle Ross has been with us this whole hour. She covers race, gender, immigration, and inequality for The Washington Post. Janelle, thanks very much for being with us this whole time.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.